Hello and thanks for joining us today. Today, I have the pleasure and honor of speaking with Dr. Todd Kashdan. After receiving his PhD in clinical psychology in 2004, Todd founded the Wellbeing Lab at George Mason University, which has produced over 225 peer-reviewed journal articles on well-being and resilience, psychological flexibility, meaning and purpose in life, curiosity, and managing social anxiety. He is among the top 1% most cited scientists in the world. Awarded the 2013 Distinguished Early Career Researcher Award by the American Psychological Association, Todd Kashdan is among the world's top experts on the psychology of well-being, psychological strengths, mental agility, and social relationships. Todd has authored 5 books?
Sounds right.
Including Curious, The Upside of Your Dark Side, and Designing Positive Psychology. In one of his latest books, The Art of Insubordination, he details research on how we can change minds and design groups and society to be smarter and wiser. He teaches us how to be courageous enough to question the status quo with the intelligence to know when and how. Dr. Kashdan, thank you for joining me today.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. I came across your work because I was studying the role of curiosity on burnout in therapists. And I used a scale that you came up with, came up with isn't the right word, but a scale that you designed, the 5-dimension curiosity scale revised.
Right.
Yeah. I was wondering, you've done a lot of study on, like I said, resilience, curiosity, and all of your studies on curiosity. Can you tell me what you've found?
Yeah. Well, first, I mean, don't bury the lead. Which dimensions were related to burnout, and was curiosity helpful?
Yeah, of course. So I studied 2 groups. One was psychoanalysts and one was therapists who have never received any psychoanalytic education. And the dimensions most related to burnout were joyous exploration, that had the highest correlation.
And
negative correlation. Yes, sir. Yeah. And then stress tolerance was also negatively correlated. And then a slight positive correlation was covert social curiosity.
Yeah. That's a good one with therapist burnout, right? The idea of, this is like another way, it's in the vein of compassion fatigue, of to what degree are you obsessively concerned with understanding your partner, but not directly, indirectly? So you're perseverating about them, you're thinking between sessions, and you can imagine is that the more that you're not able to create clear, non-permeable boundaries between when you're with your client, thinking about your client, when you're not, you're going to be more inclined towards burnout. So that's a really cool finding.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen a lot of psychoanalysts who have hypothesized in their writings, in their books, that they think perhaps psychoanalysts are more curious than a non-psychoanalyst, and that curiosity protects them against burnout, and which was part of the reasons that's what gave me the idea for the study. And I was interested that across all of the other dimensions of burnout, they ranked basically the same as non-psychoanalysts, except for on joyous exploration. That one was significantly different. They had a higher joyous exploration than non-psychoanalytically trained therapist. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, this is great. Please tell me you're going to publish this.
I'm going to do my best. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. You'll contact me afterwards if you need any help. Like, I'm happy to help you. But this is great because there's one of the big things I've been into in the Wellbeing Laboratory is trade-offs. And so there's a lot of debate in terms of what are the best therapists in terms of their modality, right? So you've got your more evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapy therapists, and you have a larger body of work on psychoanalysis in terms of how do they fare in terms of being therapists. What I like is you are skirting that entire topic, and then to what degree are there characteristics within these therapists that draws them to these areas and that allows them to be beneficial to their clients as well as to the work. And curiosity offers one dimension in there. And this builds very nicely off of your initial question, which was, what have we discovered about curiosity? We've got one paper that just went under review 2 days ago from this recording, where we were interested in, you've got a lot of work showing that curious people tend to be higher in performance, which fits with the hypotheses that you had for your study. And the question is, well, what are the mechanisms? You can't just see that more curious people are productive. Well, it's why. So we know that when you experience information that's more interesting, you learn it better, and it's more likely to go short-term into long-term memory. You process information quicker, and you have more extemporaneous creative thoughts as a result of that. But that doesn't say much about the person. That says more about situations where learning is going to function better. And so what we were interested in is, if you entered into a novel situation that was stressful, like many novel situations, there's a bit of anxiety because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And this situation was, you're asked to give a talk on what makes a good friend and whether you're a good friend. And they were told there's a 50% likelihood with your preparation, you're going to actually give the talk in front of a bunch of people and be evaluated on it. Number one fear in the world, public speaking anxiety.
Yeah.
And what we found was that curious people who entered into the situation experienced a greater vision that the situation was challenging and not threatening, and they showed higher heart rate activation, stable throughout the entire preparation period and the online period of giving these talks, which speaks to they're fully engaged physiologically. They're viewing this as, it's stressful, but it's interesting and challenging. I don't view this as a threat. And when they were told that you can't give this talk that you prepared for, they were pissed off. This is the trade-off. So being this curious person, if you enjoy these novel situations, but when you are, there's any obstruction to actually experiencing them, you have this residual unsatisfied curiosity, and that lingers and could detract from your well-being.
Oh, wow. Wow. So if you have a curiosity that's been piqued and then it never sees its fulfillment, that can detract from your well-being.
Yeah. And actually, if we want to go to the origin of what got me into this, because I am a clinical psychologist, it was my first year of grad school. I was studying how panic attacks develop. We were taking this mask with 35% CO2 and have people breathe it in. So if you were susceptible to panic attacks, you were high likely to develop a panic attack. And then, not creepy at all, I would stand behind you and ask you a bunch of questions while you're in the middle of having a panic attack of what the experience is like. And I wrote down on a piece of paper several months into this, what happens to the residual unsatisfied curiosity? Because if you're entering a situation and you are overexcited or view it as unnecessarily threatening, or it actually is threatening to you, your curiosity doesn't just disappear. It's still lingers, but it's unsatisfied. Like, what happens to a person? And I realized I was less interested in the panic attacks and more of like, here's this resource that's so wonderful. There's mysteriousness, uncertainty, complexity, and beauty of life. And what if you have an internal or external obstruction to getting there?
Wow, that's fascinating. I've come across some readings that curiosity, you know, there's like the whole debate, is it a state or a trait? And then I'm curious to know what you say about that. And it goes into, can curiosity be trained or can it only be brought out? And yeah, can you talk about those differences there?
Yeah, so I'm a big proponent of William Fleeson's model at Wake Forest, which is, think of traits as density distributions of states. And so all that means for me to say, hey, Daniel, like, you're a very agreeable person, is that if I looked at 2,000 moments over the course of a week in your life, I would see there's a preponderance of times that you're kind, compassionate, thoughtful, empathic, interested in other people, compared to being disagreeable, quarrelsome, you know, difficult, and, you know, all those other negative features. That's all that a personality trait means. And so states are the building blocks of traits. And so everyone understands what it's like to be incurious when you're hanging out with someone and they're a bad storyteller. They're not revealing that much about themselves. Maybe just their life just is a little bit bland and you're not feeling it. And people know what it's like to be like so intrigued is that you want the center of attention, not because you want to talk, because you have a ton of questions. If you meet Neil deGrasse Tyson for the first time, and you find out he was a wrestler in high school, which he was, and then became this famous astronomer, and then to deal with racism over the course of his career, the questions just are endless. And so those experiences are state experiences, a state of being incurious and a state of being curious. And the idea of being a curious person is just that have a more preponderance of curious states. You stay in that state more longer. It tends to be more enduring. And it ends up being like more intense in terms of it affects more elements of your life. Hmm.
And is it that the environment, some people are in an environment that facilitates or brings out that state better? Or is it that some people have less of that propensity, no matter what state they're in?
Yeah, so I'm going to tell you about a paper that had a big influence on me. I think it came out in 1990. Huh. Forgot the scientist's name. My apologies. but the name of the paper is Mental Retardation and Curiosity. Hmm. And I read this paper, and there's not that much science in it. It's more like a conceptual paper. Uh-huh. And the idea is that from his experience of working with people with mental retardation, although I know we're not really using that word anymore, I'm using the word of the scientific article, that while by definition, these are individuals with lower IQ scores, not necessarily practical intelligence, but analytical intelligence and problem-solving skills to help them function in life, this has zero influence on their curiosity. And discovered is that these individuals had the same distribution of curiosity as anyone else in society. And oftentimes they'd be more curious because their difficulty of being able to engage in daily functioning, of preparing their own foods, of figuring out how to kind of take care of their bills, of thinking about for a 3-month plan for their budget. With this difficulty, it raises lots of questions. With these questions is, it's not necessarily the joyous curiosity. It's more of the stress of, I have no idea how to do this. I know it's important. What the hell do I do? And so the beauty of this work, it says that curiosity is the province of everyone. Whether you have traumatic brain injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder, low cognitive functioning. And that's why it's more interesting to me than studying something like intelligence or in more specifically IQ.
Yeah. Yeah, because if it's in everyone and everyone has, let's say, the ability to access this internal thing, that if they can tap into it, they could experience burnout to lesser degrees. They can have report overall well-being higher than if they were, all of these different things. Then the question that I'm attempting to explore is, how can we best help people to be curious?
Yeah, and I think you facilitated that a little bit earlier, which is, what types of environments can we design that allow curiosity to be activated versus deactivated? Yeah. So one of the things that we know in terms of mandatory schooling from kindergarten through 12th grade, we don't see much of a difference in college and undergrad and grad school for most professors, is there's a very strict hierarchy, where the authority figure determines what questions are going to be asked, what content's going to be covered, and we have a curriculum that we're going to make sure that we hit within each lesson, each class, and over the course of months and the entire semester. And I would argue that this is not the desirable approach if you're thinking about how do we create like interest and curiosity informed learning, kind of John Dewey approach, where you're interested in developing skills, proficiencies that are not to pass the test, but to actually develop lifelong learning. No. And so the idea is, if you're teaching a class on the psychology of driving and you want to cover automaticity on the road and attentional focus and, change blindness, all those things are important. But if people in the class are interested in how it's different developmentally, or how it's different in a culture where it's like Vietnam, where there's almost no street signs and there's no traffic lights, mm-hmm. and most people are on scooters, versus in the United States, where you have very clear lines. It's almost, you know, always highways and freeways. Now you're bringing culture into the equation. A typical instructor professor says, great question and thought, but we're going off topic. Let's return to my lesson plan. Uh-huh. And I would say that's not the way that you should be teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Have kind of an overarching topic and then let the class facilitate discussion and go where they go.
Yeah. And in some ways, there's an analog here to a cognitive behavioral therapist writ large versus a psychoanalyst, where a psychoanalyst gives a lot more of a playground for the client in terms of where you go. Where a cognitive behavioral therapist will often have, here's going to be a 12-session program to help you develop some habits to cope better with generalized anxiety disorder or excessive uncontrollable worry.
Yeah.
Now, is the cognitive behavioral therapist the better approach between the two? I think when you look at the data, the science is relatively mixed with a little bit of a bump for cognitive behavioral therapy. But I do think we haven't fully explored the nature of the give and take interactions. To what degree does this play a role in your motivation to come back for the next session, your motivation to do work outside of the session, and to what degree does this curiosity lead you to more self-reflection and more self-directed questions outside of the therapy session? I haven't seen these kind of mechanisms that have been explored in therapy and in the aftermath of therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. Going off of that, you mentioned earlier that you're in the process of looking at different therapeutic styles or modalities. Can you talk a little bit more about that work?
Oh, I'm not doing, I just researched the research. So okay. I'm not directly doing this work. I'm just thinking of ideas for you because it's something that thankfully you're actually diving into.
Yeah. Any thoughts on how we can foster curiosity in clinicians, clinical psychologists, therapists?
I think the most important thing is for them to have developed. To me, there's a virtue triad between intellectual humility, perspective getting and taking, and curiosity. And I think we often train people to be a little bit more narcissistic in their clinical practice than they should be. It's kind of like this, you know, like a surgeon, like this. These Godhead approaches where we are the master of human behavior and insight, and you get someone who's been doing this for 20, 30 years, and they'll often, with really good pattern recognition, say, you know what? I've seen you before. Like your prototype, the way that you behave, the way that you're approaching the world, the way that your relationships seem to have difficulties. This is a common problem I've seen. As opposed to starting with a little bit more of a clean slate, which is, however you're experiencing your attachment anxiety with your romantic partner, it's going to be unique and different from any other human that will ever walk the earth. And I want to detect and discern those patterns. That's a very different approach to thinking about therapy. And I think we have to start from the beginning of you're constantly developing hypotheses, hold them loosely. I will be disappointed if by session four, you haven't developed new hypotheses or rethought your hypotheses from before you saw someone and the first few sessions. And that's not how I was trained. And I don't know many people that have been trained that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you name that triad again?
Yeah. To me, it's intellectual humility, is that you have less information than you actually think you do. And other people are a source of information, even if they're not part of your in-group. And so you should be open to accessing them. The other is perspective getting and taking. A lot of time is spent on perspective taking of, I can understand what it's like for you kind of being a grad student about to go on internship because I've been there before, but I haven't worked to get your perspective. I've basically just superimposed my world onto yours versus spent time asking, you know, Daniel himself, what is it like for you as a grad student now? What's it like to go, you know, to be on in the pursuit of internship now? That's the perspective getting, which should be the precursor to taking. And then their third one is curiosity.
Okay, Great. Yeah. That reminds me, Dr. Nance McWilliams said she always ensures to ask, what is your theory of your symptoms, or what is your theory of what you're coming to me with? I have my theories, but what is yours? And like in the first session, trying to, so that reminds me of the perspective getting.
Yeah. No, and that's great. And to be honest, I've never had a therapist who's actually done that before. Uh-huh. And I've never supervised anyone who's actually done that before.
Hmm. Yeah. So that seems like, but I like that triad. Do you have that triad? Do you have any published articles, or is that in any of your books?
It's in the last one, The Art of Insubordination, where I spend time really thinking about how are you persuasive if you lack power and status? You know, we talk a lot about power and status over the past 5 years in society, but we haven't really talked about how do you be persuasive other than just acknowledging that you should, because there should be a more of an even distribution of resources in an environment.
Yeah. What was your inspiration for the art of insubordination?
I mean, to be honest, I thought that there was excessive and unhelpful strategies that were being pushed under the umbrella of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And these are all things that I value, but it's the actual tactics and strategies and tools that I often thought were doing the exact opposite of what was expected. And as we're talking right now, we are a couple days off when Dartmouth decided to undo one of those strategies, which was we're going to remove achievement testing in terms of evaluating potential applicants for colleges. And Dartmouth said, actually, looking at our data, as opposed to ideologically, we realized that actually low-income applicants that apply for Dartmouth are at a disadvantage without achievement test scores, not at an advantage. And this was one of my problems, is that people were developing all sorts of strategies without evidence and support. And you didn't have people that were emboldened to speak against the tide of, if you criticize this, you were against it and it's not part of your value system, which goes against everything we know about group dynamics, is that you actually want people that are detractors that are in there. Best case scenario, you have to describe your ideas more clearly and realize maybe there are some flaws in logic and how you're thinking. Worst case scenario, you realize you were going down the wrong direction and you discovered some flaws as a detractor pointed them out, as opposed to a bunch of people nodding their head.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll have to admit, I haven't read The Art of Insubordination yet. I would really like to. And I, one of the things I thought of is, I remember studying in a group therapy class, and it was like one of the first things you do in order to avoid groupthink is you encourage dissent. And dissent is definitely not encouraged in our current culture. I don't know that it ever is encouraged in culture, but you probably have researched that for your book. And it makes me think of a lot of the, I don't know, even like Jesus pops in my head, that he was someone who went against his culture and his time and spun things in a different direction. There's a lot of people like that throughout. It seems like a lot of the people throughout history that we look back on and made a big impact are people who thought differently, spoke out, and went their own path.
Yeah. I mean, just choose your favorite iconic figure. Mahatma Gandhi devoted his entire life to developing enlightenment in other people and actually protect India from their oppressor, Great Britain. In doing this, he had terrible relationships with all of his children, spent no time in terms of being a parent. And it's important to realize that there was a trade-off. It's a trade-off in terms of, I care more about the country than I care about my familial and paternal relationships biologically. And if he was to do that now with social media, he'd be crushed on X and Threads and Instagram, of the idea of of there'd be a picture of him, you know, shooing his kids away that want to spend time with him, of saying, I am devoting my life to kind of like my develop my own enlightenment and that of, you know, the citizens of India to stand up against Great Britain. And all people would care about is the negativity of, shoot, you're not paying attention to your wife and you're not paying attention to your kids. And if you looked at Martin Luther King, I mean, he had a number of infidelities. And if he was around during social media, there'd be great attention of, in terms of, listen, great speaking, oratorical skills are amazing. I think you're having a great aspirational vision of society. Here are some photographs and videos of him having infidelities.
He would have been canceled.
Yeah. And it's worth thinking about this because in two ways. One is that I like to think for young people in society, these people are, you can pull them down from the lofty pedestals and say, if you look at the flaws and the strengths of the Mahatma Gandhis and the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's and the Frederick Douglasses, is that you can have, your profile is more similar to them than you think. And it is attainable to have this kind of influence, positive influence on society. And on the other end of this, we cannot continue to define people by the mistakes and failures that they make, because it is a small smidgen of their full holistic persona. And can we hold simultaneously at the same time strengths and virtues, weaknesses and mistakes, and not just as a platitude, but actual human beings that bother us the most?
Yeah, I think that that's very important, a very important point. A few things come to my mind, like we don't live too far from Thomas Jefferson's estate. I'm trying to think of Monticello. And we were telling some of our classmates and different friends about our visit there, and it was amazing and it was a lot of fun. And they even have a kind of a historical like class where they talk about Thomas Jefferson owning slaves and the relationship to his slaves and stuff like that. And we told our friends about it, and some of them said, oh yeah, I thought I would like to go, but you know, he held slaves and I don't really want to go support that or go, whatever that might look like. But there is at Monticello, like some of those slaves that were released and then their like grandchildren or great grandchildren, they all went back to Monticello, and there's a big group photo of them. And it's like, they can go, but you can't go. Because you don't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, right.
Yeah, a lot of, they can't hold both at the same time and appreciate his positive impact on America and the Declaration, all these different things, because he had this negative flaw or whatever it might be that they're looking back on.
Well, here we are, two psychologists that are very interested in clinical care, improving well-being, and reducing human suffering. And so There are bright spots as well as the other trends. So a few days before this recording, you had this beautiful song of Tracy Chapman at the Grammys, where she was redoing her song, her famous song, along with Luke Combs, and the two of, and you have these two people on stage that are truly loving each other. Luke Combs, you can see, is like in awe of being with his hero on stage, and then Tracy Chapman is in love with this guy who basically reignited her entire career 30 years later. And there's this harmonious experience. And yet, if you follow the breadcrumbs before that trail, which was, there was accusations of that you're misappropriating her work, a white country singer, you know, taking a, and doing a cover of a black woman's beautiful musical work in this case. And all of that infantilizes the two actual protagonists in the story, just as you're describing Monticello, which is, it's clear they get along great. She's making a killing financially off of this. She loves the attention, but she actually doesn't like being in the spotlight, which is why she hasn't been in the spotlight for the past 20 years. And everyone's wondered what's happened to Tracy Chapman. And I think the really important psychological piece at a societal level is to be curious about what elements of society are causing more dysfunction than good, even if it feels morally righteous to engage in those behaviors. Is it causing more harm than good?
That's an important question. And it makes me think too of Oh, what was it? I just saw it last night. It was basically it's basically the idea that there's this thing that you look at and it looks like it's broken or it looks like it needs fixing, and you fix it here, but then as a result there are all of these other things that are impacted in the process. And it's a lot of times the solution seems so simple and you try to fix it, but because of that so many things change. And there's this saying I like, you talk a lot about trade-offs, or you've mentioned it a few times. It's like, there is no solution, there's only a trade-off. And I think thinking about, do I know that this, me trying to fix this problem, is going to bring about good? And why am I so sure that I'm not going to do any harm in the process? I think that's a very important question.
Yeah. That's Sowell's quote, famous economist who is beloved by the right and despised by the left for, as opposed to, I mean, one of the things that we study in the Wellbeing Laboratory is how can you be open to accessing information even if you don't like the messengers, because there's wisdom there. Uh-huh. And that's really important. I mean, the idea of if you took political affiliations in the United States, are you really saying 50% is off limits, whatever they produce, artistically, epistemically, architecturally, as a function of their political orientation? Or am I willing almost anyone to be the source and I can separate message and messenger? And I want to train my kids and the next generations to really disentangle these two, because wisdom shouldn't be lost because you happen to think that the other person is not someone you'd want to be friends with.
Yeah. Curiosity here. did your work in curiosity lead you to, like, did it lead you to the art of insubordination? Are people who are higher in curiosity more likely to dissent or to go their own path? Or was it a different trail that led you there?
Yeah, there's a great study by Dominic Packer at Lehigh University where he wanted to know who's most likely to engage in constructive dissent in an organization. Because you can dissent and just say, listen, I'm not working 40 hours a week. Yeah. And because everyone else at other companies are talking about hybrid work and it's basically unfair and you're not thinking about my balance in life. Sometimes the work has to get done. If you're, you know, if you work at an ER, if you're, you know, an airline pilot, the work just has to get done. And what he found was that constructive dissent was most common in people that had a combination of two traits, high in openness to experience and high in conscientiousness. Now, if you weren't high in both, you didn't have the maximum level. It's a beautiful thing if you think about it, because combinatorial personality qualities make so much more sense than the hyper-focus on singular things. There's so much work on neuroticism, or the other endpoint, emotional stability. There's so much work on social anxiety, or the amount that people worry or they're perfectionistic. But we treat these individual traits in isolation. If you're curious, but you don't tend to persevere long-term at your goals, then you're probably unlikely to. You might find a hole or a problem in how a group is functioning, but unlikely to deal with the friction and the negative evaluation of being judged by people who say, can you just stop talking and asking questions so these meetings can go quicker and I can get home quicker?
Yeah.
So it's an inefficiency in the system to being curious. So you need the conscientiousness is that you're going to stick to it besides being open and exploring new things.
That makes sense. And so are you saying that people who were higher in curiosity and higher in conscientiousness were more likely to become constructive dissenters?
Right.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, a big part of this whole work, which is much of the book, is it's the systems and institutions and norms that are really more, even more influential than the characteristics of the individual.
Oh.
So if you and I worked at some company that was making, you know, therapy apps to kind of improve people's well-being, and the norm of the group was, when we get together in a boardroom, I want us to be positive. I want cohesion. I want unanimity for all decisions. Everyone to agree before we move forward on something. It sounds nice, but it's going to interfere with progress, creativity, innovation, and just thinking like really deeply about whether what we're doing is the right way of doing things among competing options. Hmm. And so what you want is competitiveness, but collaborative, positive, but at the same time, constructive criticism. And you want people to be rewarded for finding the right solution and the answers, as opposed to being a nice person in the room. And often the incentives are not aligned with constructive dissent. And so you get what you mentioned earlier, groupthink. Hmm.
Okay, that makes sense. In your, are you currently looking into, let's say, with the well-being lab, I assume you do a lot of work with positive psychology. Can you talk a little bit about your aims there and maybe what you're finding or what your focus is on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of us who identify with positive psychology say that we hope this term disappears, which I think it kind of has, because I want it to be integrated everywhere. So John Rottenberg and I, for example, and his team published a number of papers of to what degree are people that suffer from psychopathology. You have a major depressive episode, you develop post-traumatic stress disorder, you have you make a suicide attempt. And then what percentage of people, if you follow them 5-10 years later, are not just not suffering, are not just okay, but are actually flourishing and having an incredible life. And we find, for example, for people that experience the depths of despair of a major depressive episode, about 10% of those people are at the upper 10th, like top 10 percentile of positive relationships with other people, sense of purpose in life, feeling competent, feeling a sense of belonging, experiencing positive emotions, experiencing life satisfaction. And that doesn't fit with any of our models. And so in some ways, we have integrated clinical psychology and psychopathology with well-being science. And this is kind of, to me, the future is this well-being science should be integrated into everything such that there is no thing called positive psychology where it's studying it in isolation.
Hmm. That's interesting. I haven't heard of that before. I've heard of people criticizing the term positive psychology or saying, you know, it's not all about being happy or something, but I haven't heard about it wanting to integrate it so much to the point that that's what we're aiming toward. So why call it something different? You know?
Yeah.
Why it's like, yeah.
I mean, it's great marketing. Listen, Marty Seligman has made millions of dollars off of this term. And people have their shingle up as I'm a positive psychology coach. Hmm. I'm a positive psychology workplace. And so I would say if you remove the marketing piece of it, it's a nice, cute little term. Hmm. It's actually useless because if you're focusing on positive psychology in the workplace and you're not dealing with burnout, work-life balance, presenteeism where you're present but you're not fully engaged, or absenteeism of people are not showing up because of mental health issues or family issues, relational issues, then you're not a positive psychology workplace. No. You have to be dealing with the dialectic of there are negative things, there are positive things. And sometimes, and this is a lot of the work that Robert Biswas Dieter and I have done, what you think is negative is actually healthy. And that's where there are benefits for anger, there are benefits for guilt, and there are benefits for low levels of narcissism and psychopathy.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, so I read a lot of Dr. Nancy McWilliams and I listen to her. She was talking about one of her qualms is that, yeah, exactly like what you said, what we think might be negative is actually healthy. She was saying a lot of times in therapy, let's say that your patient or your client has to do, so they come in, they're doing okay, but then they end up, you do a grief work with them. Well, there might be a pretty long period where they're going to start rating, their symptoms are going to increase. They're going to have more negative emotion. They're going to have, they're going to score higher on maybe the Beck depression inventory for a few weeks because they're actually doing the grief work that they've suppressed or put off for so long. And that's not, that's actually an indication that things are progressing in that case.
Yeah. God, what a great criticism of the literature on the science of clinical trials. Right. So like if you're 37 years old and you've never gone to therapy and you've been experiencing social anxiety since you were a teenager, average age of onset is around 15 and a half years of age. And you start exposing yourself to flawed thinking and avoidance behaviors. Yeah. Why would you expect an increase anytime soon as you're starting to first kind of delve into this, this life of difficulty that you haven't been willing to even touch or have any friction?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I wanted to go back for a second to this, maybe continuing on the same line, but also going back to curiosity in the workplace and constructive dissent, and you talking about a lot of your hope or your dream is that a lot of your work paves the way for your children, for our future generations. I know, like, so you're writing these books, you're doing these, all of these different things. Is the hope, like, I was going to ask, how do you make system-wide change? Or you talk about this, a lot of the problem is with the programs or the systems that are in place. Is the hope that they'll read your work and they'll make system changes, or is there some consulting that needs to be done? Is it a multi-factored approach? What is the mechanism of change here?
Yeah. I mean, I do a lot of consulting for organizations, everything from, government offices to, leaders in the world in other countries. I mean, you hope that people read the work and then they integrate it in some way. And then they ask me questions and they start to implement it. I mean, what we know about groups, I mean, it's basically the question of what percentage of individuals in a group do you need to have a shift in norms? And there's a good section of the book of reviewing the literature on this. And the data shows that it's about somewhere between 20 to 25% of a group shifting their norms, where it starts to have an exponential effect of emotional contagion or thought contagion of influencing other people, especially if those are intentionally socially attractive people who you're trying to throw into the system and actually bring in a modified view into the system. So one of the things that we know, a lot of this is done in Canada, this work, in terms of anti-bullying programs, many of them have been ineffective in the United States. It's because the focus is to kind of, we're just going to have at an authority level, change the rewards and punishments for aggressive play, whether it's physical, whether it's emotional, or whether it's relational aggression. And in Canada, a lot of schools explored the idea of, what if we brought really popular people in, made them the facilitators of teach, so they would train other students in terms of how to respond to a bully, how to respond when someone's actually being aggressive or unnecessarily cruel to you or someone else. And so you role play, you teach skills, but the key thing is the socially attractive people are the ones that are facilitators. Now, some of them probably are some of the bullies that are in there. So either way, we know that one of the best ways of dealing with children with externalizing problems in a classroom is help them be a co-facilitator of the class, because now their role is shifted from being the class clown and nuisance to being they're designing the class with you. And the same thing for our anti-bullying program. You find that once you get about 20% of a room to modify their views, other people see it. There's a paper that came out in Psych Science about this, is the perception of the speed of minority influence. As you see a rise from 0 to 20%, everyone feels like, oh, so this is the direction we're going. Bullying is no longer cool. And then more people jump on the bandwagon, and then you see critical mass. And I think when we think about the workplace or in grad school or in, you know, or in a PTA, a parent-teacher association, is thinking about critical mass comes at about 20 to 25%. So the question is, those how do we get the early purveyors of this knowledge or information to be influential so that other people will jump in, as opposed to just the people that already agreed with them are going to clap and cheer for them. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the mistake that a lot of activists make, is they don't think about people that are on the fence. They think of who's already in their chain of command and on their side, and I want to make them louder as opposed to bringing in more people.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting take. That leads me into a question. I was asked on one of my internship interviews, they said, if you could change anything in psychology, what would you change? So I want to ask you that same question. With all of this, yeah, what would you change?
What was your answer first?
My answer, my wife, she's also in the clinical psychology program, and she's doing her dissertation on some of Dr. Redding's work. Dr. Redding and Dr. Nina Salander, they do work on looking at basically political values in psychology, and I think it's like 80% or higher of psychologists, especially social psychologists, are on the left, or they lean left politically. And they're working on trying to, along with diversity, trying to encourage our skills and experience as clinical psychologists working with patients that are politically different from us, perhaps, as well as try to figure out how they can bring in more right-leaning or conservative people into clinical psychology to kind of balance out the field. So I was saying that if I could change something, I would probably just try and shift the focus within diversity a little bit more toward that area, because I think it's underappreciated or underrepresented or undertrained, especially. Especially like, how do you work with perhaps a conservative who comes into your office wearing like a MAGA Trump hat? So, you know, and what is that going to do, and how is that going to impact how you treat them? And I think it's a skill that a lot of people don't currently have or are trained in.
No, that's great. And Richard Redding, him and I get along quite well, and I agree with most of the things that he says. So that makes me very pleased that the two of you are both doing amazing work together. Power couple. You can use an even less provocative example, is people that are religious, which is still, 40% some odd of the United States. I know it's mostly now older Americans versus younger Americans. Is, can you treat them, realizing that they're coming there for a psychological difficulty that they want help on, without you imposing your ideological views on them, because that might prevent them from coming back and then ever seeing a therapist again.
Yeah.
And so again, is your ideological commitment so much that it overrides your willingness to actually do more help than good to an individual who is actively suffering from psychological difficulties? And I think that's a question that should be posed regularly in classrooms, in practicums, anyone who's kind of like, in the allied health professions that's going to be on the front lines.
Yeah, and not attributing their psychological distress to their views. If someone comes in and they say they're religious, they're fundamentalist Christian, and they're conservative, and they're coming in with some type of psychological distress, I think it might be easier to assume that a lot of this distress is coming from your backward or your, old fashioned views.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that Rogerian approach of having this non-judgmental attitude towards your therapist is something that we really have to talk about going back to. And I think it's very troublesome. The idea of any human being who is suffering, who goes to see a therapist, is rebuffed because of their tangential to the issue ideological views, and then never sees a therapist again, is very concerning to me, because especially when you think about, suicidality and paranoia and, the health and economic cost of you know, depression and anxiety disorders. These are serious issues. Anytime you obstruct someone from the therapeutic options.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what would your answer be?
For me, I think it's that we have to stop rewarding the wrong questions and levels of analysis. And I think most granting agencies have put too much of their thumb on the scale where neuroscience is going to be what we're going to be focusing on over the past 25 years. Mm. And when you think about the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent of grant agencies to focus on those questions and the minuscule amount of knowledge on the Human Genome Project and its relation to human psychology, how mm-hmm. little we've learned about this that we couldn't have learned at levels of analysis such as thinking, behavior, and what do people actually do in their everyday environments. I find that problematic because it's what you didn't fund over the same period of time in terms of basic understanding about social behavior. How do we reduce loneliness? How do we actually improve people's abilities to form friendships and stronger social ties? If that was done over the past 25 years, who knows what the rate would be right now in terms of mental health difficulties, rates of loneliness, and then maybe we wouldn't have, you know, 20 to 40% of the population saying that I don't have one close confidant or friend in my life. To me, that's a much more important issue than to what degree is the prefrontal cortex and nucleus accumbens involved in for parent-child relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something that I can get behind. There's, I don't know if this is, I'm trying to remember the ICEP. Have you heard of the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, ICEP?
Mm-hmm. No.
No. There's this, I just recently learned about it, but, and I'm reading a book by the, he's like the founder, or not, maybe not the founder, but he's the top guy right now. But it's a lot about, it's kind of criticizing the medical model when it comes to mental health. And he takes the approach that there is no real mental illness, and that it's not a medical thing. And if it was, if you could do a brain scan or find that it was in the genes, then it's no longer a mental illness. It's a medical problem. And they would see a medical professional. So I don't know. I'm still kind of looking into that. But I do agree that I think focusing on like the Human Genome Project or focusing on brain scans and trying to figure out the underlying medical or biological thing that's happening, we're taking a lot of the focus off of humanity and human interaction and what helps us thrive and what helps us with our well-being.
Yeah. I mean, there are very few studies, and when I'm going to teach about this, I realize how few studies are interesting enough that I could teach a bunch of undergraduate students where it would have an influence on their lives. It's more of like, I sound smart because I name a bunch of neurological parts. There's some interesting correlations. Rarely ever can you actually even come close to causality. And the question is, could I have discussed exactly what I was discussing without mentioning neurological mechanisms, which is not something that's directly in control of by an individual versus just their you know, thoughts, emotions, and behaviors.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think we have to end here, but this has been a very delightful conversation. And thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, listen, I didn't know your research. I didn't know your girlfriend or wife's research. And so this has been fabulous. Great questions.